Good morning. Good morning. Please be seated. Ms. Clerk, before we move into the first matter this morning, which is Rinker Materials versus the 8th Judicial District Court, Mr. O'Connor, I would like to note that we are desirous of moving the two second and third arguments up behind one another. That would be City of North Las Vegas versus Warburton and City of Las Vegas versus Warburton. For some reason in our schedule, they're set half hour apart. If you are able to see the attorneys as they come in and advise them of that, we would appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And with that, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, do you wish to reserve time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. Thank you, and may it please the court, Anthony Golden on behalf of petitioners. We're here on a writ petition from a denied motion to dismiss in the district court in a workers' compensation matter. Now, although the parties disagree whether the stipulated settlement agreement in this case obligates Rinker to pay for O'Connor's medication, what the issue really boils down to here is what's the proper forum to decide that dispute. The Nevada Industrial Insurance Act preempts Mr. O'Connor's common law claims. And that conclusion can be drawn from several sources. First, the general purpose of the Industrial Insurance Act. Second, several of the specific statutes within the Act. And third, this court's interpretation of those statutes. Now, the general purpose of the Industrial Insurance Act creates a quick, efficient resolution of claims for workers. The statutes require a neutral interpretation of the Act, and it's not to favor one party over the other. And in agreeing to abide by the Act, the employer gives up certain rights. One of those rights is the right to be free from having to pay compensation when it would not otherwise be liable. And that's exactly the situation we have here. Rinker had nothing to do with Mr. O'Connor's injuries. But for the Industrial Insurance Act, Rinker would not be obligated to pay Mr. O'Connor anything. So it makes sense that a claim under the Act, even for breach of the settlement agreement, would be brought within the system so that Rinker can take advantage of the efficient, quick remedial procedures in the Act. The specific statutes within the Act also indicate that Mr. O'Connor should bring his claims administratively and that he cannot proceed in court. First of all, we start with NRS 616C.495, which provides that if a claimant accepts a lump sum settlement, which is what we have here, all claims for compensation are terminated and the settlement is final as to all issues of fact and law.
Of course, counsel, you carved out some sections in your stipulation, did you not?
We did not carve out any specific sections as far as waiving any rights under the Act. Now, point 616C.495 makes the settlement agreement, a lump sum payment, conclusive as to facts and legal issues under the law, except it allows for the reopening of claims. And that's exactly the type of situation we have here.
Well, is this really a reopened claim? When I look at the settlement agreement, paragraphs 6, 7, and 8, it appears as though the issue of continued medication, as well as offsets and liens, were left open and undecided in the settlement agreement. But the question in front of the district court judge was, on a motion to dismiss, I should examine the complaint based upon and give all deference to the plaintiff and their allegations. That's the standard in front of us today. So what's your argument that the district court committed error in denying the motion to dismiss?
In denying the motion to dismiss, the district court erred because these claims, although they were excluded from the settlement, can only be decided under the Industrial Insurance Act. Therefore, the Act preempts the common law claims, and that's why the district court should have dismissed it on its face, on the face of the complaint.
So your argument is that the district court, in response to the motion to dismiss, should have interpreted the agreement, and in interpreting the agreement found that these claims were reserved to NIA to resolve, not or to the workers' compensation system to resolve, not by way of a separate complaint in a district court.
Well, I don't think the court needed to even go so far as to interpret the agreement. It's just the fact that there's a breach of this stipulated settlement that was born out of the workers' compensation system.
Well, in the complaint, it is alleged on page 3, paragraph 11, line 11 and 12, in reference to the stipulated settlement, and Rinker agreed to continue providing O'Connor's health benefits, including medications and doctor's visits related thereto. So the complaint alleges that that is a contractual obligation assumed by Rinker in the settlement agreement. I assume you disputed that.
Yes.
Because it's not in the language.
Right.
Was there any other document, affidavit, information provided to the district court that suggested that this language was part of the agreement when the motion to dismiss was decided?
No, Your Honor. There was nothing else provided regarding the interpretation of that part of the agreement.
When the motion to dismiss was presented to Judge Glass, my understanding is that she referred it back to the hearing officer to make a determination whether medication issues were still in front of workers' compensation?
That's correct.
And the hearing officer said, yes, they are.
That is our interpretation of the hearing officer's order. That's correct. What Judge Glass sort of did was treat this as a quasi-petition for judicial review, even though it was a complaint, because if this were just a normal complaint, there would be no basis to send the matter back to the appeals officer to look at that issue.
When the judge did that, did it expand the standard of review from a motion to dismiss to a summary judgment or to a this procedure is very confusing because I've never seen this before, where a district court judge in response to a motion to dismiss remands it to the appeals officer to say, what did the settlement agreement say?
Yeah, I understand, Your Honor, and we're a little bit confused as well. We think the appropriate procedure would have been for Judge Glass to dismiss the case, allow it to proceed through the workers' compensation system in the first instance, and then could only take up the matter on a petition for judicial review. What she did instead, as you note, was she sent it back only to the appeals officer for the limited issue of trying to interpret the settlement agreement. Now, we agree that that issue needs to be dealt with within the system, but upon getting the case back from the appeals officer, Judge Glass should have dismissed it so that could proceed through the system. I'm not entirely clear on why she proceeded the way that she did. Unfortunately, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, the mechanics of it, but I think the appropriate remedy here is for the case to be dismissed so that it can proceed through the system so that the issues of one, whether Mr. O'Connor is owed anything by Rinker under the agreement or under the act otherwise, and two, whether Rinker is entitled to an offset. Normally, Mr. O'Connor would have to bring his claim through the system and show that he exhausted all of his settlement proceeds from the third-party tort action that he recovered. There's been no showing of that here. So it's unusual. We're at an unusual procedural place right now, and I think the appropriate remedy is
counsel, why did your client continue to pay medication costs after the settlement if it believed that medication was not a part of the settlement and was yet to be decided by the appeals officer?
Well, they paid the medication up until Mr. O'Connor received the settlement under the third-party tort action.
And where is that contained in your stipulation? I mean, where do you make those provisions within your stipulation?
It's not, and that's the problem. The stipulation is silent as to any material terms that would obligate Rinker to pay Mr. O'Connor payment for medication. What it does is it leaves the issue open to be determined through the system.
Well, excuse me, counsel, I have an additional question beyond what Justice Sata just asked you. Where in the record is it reflected that Rinker's decision to discontinue payments was tied to a settlement?
Your Honor, it's in a letter, evidenced in a letter from the attorney that represented Rinker in the workers' compensation matter. And if I can just find it.
Do you have that record site, counsel? If you don't, go ahead and finish your argument. Maybe after argument, you
sure.
could give it to
yeah.
the clerk
it's,
and she could.
It's also cited in the brief.
All right. Thank you.
And that evidences that Rinker stopped paying at that time. Now, there was one extra payment after that. I can't explain it. We don't know why that happened.
So we have a letter that is extraneous to the stipulation that you are seeking to enforce the terms of essentially here. Or
well, we're not seeking to enforce the terms of the stipulation. We're arguing that the issue of...
Well, the letter.
I'm sorry.
The letter. You're seeking to enforce the terms of the letter, which is not a part of the stipulation.
Well, I think if the stipulation needs to be interpreted, and Mr. O'Connor argues that parole evidence would be needed to interpret the letter, or I'm sorry, the stipulation, if that were to happen, it needs to happen within the system, not in front of the district court. Now, the district court, several of the specific statutes provide Mr. O'Connor with remedies to go through the system. And I believe my time is almost up here. So I'm actually going to say that a writ should issue to prevent the case from proceeding in district court and directing the district court to dismiss the case so that it can proceed through the system under the several statutes that allow for that procedure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Golden. Mr. Sterling, on behalf of the Real Party in Interest.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. The issue in this case is whether the district court has jurisdiction to adjudicate a claim for breach of contract arising out of the settlement agreement in a workers' compensation case. The answer to that undoubtedly is yes. District court does have jurisdiction on a breach of contract action to resolve the obligations under that settlement agreement.
I guess that's where I'm stuck. I'm not sure I see the obligation, at least clearly. You know, it's hinted that there may be some ongoing medical benefits provided, but it doesn't. Where's the obligation specifically, looking strictly at the terms of the stipulation? It says, you know, it was well stated in the complaint. It was indicated that in consideration giving up 2% of the PPD benefits, there was an agreement to pay ongoing medication costs, but it's nowhere in the stipulation that specific.
That's true, Your Honor.
Is there something I'm missing, though, other than paragraph 11 and or not paragraph 11, paragraph 7 and paragraph 8 in the stipulation?
Your Honor, you're correct that there's nothing in the settlement agreement that specifically addresses the nature of the obligation. But I'm going to answer this question by referring back to the standard of review and where we are on this, in this proceeding on a writ of mandamus action. And Justice Sata, you're right. What there is a carve-out of the claim or continuing obligation to pay the medical benefits and the prescription drugs. It's not part of expressly a part of the settlement agreement. It's carved out of the settlement agreement. But we're here on a motion to dismiss, and it does specifically say in the complaint, as Justice Hardesty referred to, that there is an obligation, continuing obligation, to pay the medical benefits and the prescription drug costs. And for the purpose of these proceedings, everything in the complaints is accepted as true. As Rinker has acknowledged at page 19 of the at page 19 of the appendix in their motion to dismiss, they specifically say that the actual issue of what the obligation is not presently before the court, and I believe that that was repeated here today. We're not here to decide the underlying factual issues, what the obligation is. We're simply here to decide, assuming there is such an obligation, whether the district court has the jurisdiction to hear it or whether it might otherwise be prohibited by the workers' compensation statutes.
Why wouldn't it simply be considered part of an open claim under the NIIA?
Well, I think the difficulty there, Your Honor, and you know, this case is complicated by the unusual nature of it, or what at least appears to be an unusual nature. It's very common to have settlements of workers' compensation claims at the end of the to finally resolve the issues. But I think the problem here is that if you look at the actual order that was entered by the agency, it does say that that there is a final resolution and that the claims are finally resolved.
As it relates to the PPD or all claims? Is it that specific? I'm looking for that order.
Sorry, Your Honor. Well, what it says is that the, and I'm looking at page 14 specifically of the appendix. Well, the agreement was that it would be closed except for the medications. Just let me leave it at that. And then I guess in terms of the order itself, it's left a little bit ambiguous. But our position is that that the claim's not being left open for the purpose of the medical benefits and the prescription drug and the doctor's visits, but that was resolved as a part of the settlement and the dismissal, and that's a continuing obligation to pay under the terms of the settlement agreement.
Well, so, in what respect does your client contend that Rinker has breached the settlement agreement other than non-payment of medications?
That's the only breach that we're alleging here, Your Honor, is the continuing medical benefits, including specifically the obligation to pay for the medications going forward. And just to clarify one point that came up when counsel was up before on opening, in fact, there was a continuing payment of those benefits after the third-party settlement monies were received. I think it continued for a month or 4 months. It's not clear from the record, however. It's in page 35 of the appendix, I believe it is. There's a reference in the argument of counsel to that fact. And there is a letter in the appendix. I think it's page 65, which also references the continuing payments beyond that point. But again, under the standard of review where we are here today, that's something that would be resolved in the district court after there's discovery and an opportunity to have either summary judgment or a factual resolution by trial.
Well, other than the appeals officer's decision, which is an odd approach by a district court judge to a motion to dismiss, did the district court judge consider any other matter outside of the complaint in deciding the motion to dismiss?
I don't think, to answer that question directly, Your Honor, I think the answer is no, that this was done on a dismissal basis and not a summary judgment basis. There certainly wasn't, there weren't affidavits attached setting forth anything beyond the complaint. And really the reason that wasn't necessary is because
So how did the letter get in the record and the discussion about medication payments being terminated? That would seem like those are matters that are outside the complaint.
As is the stipulation.
Well, the stipulation was attached to the complaint. Yeah. So I think that's incorporated within the terms of the complaint, not something that brings this outside of a motion to dismiss. But the reason I say that the court didn't rely on those other matters, although they were submitted to the court, is that it says right in the motion to dismiss that none of that stuff is relevant. And so O'Connor and O'Connor's attorneys, I think, relied on that representation and so, did not submit affidavits and other things.
So is it fair to also understand, Mr. Sherling, that in response to the motion to dismiss, you did not argue or that the subsequent payments of medications after the settlement would not form an evidentiary basis for interpretation of the stipulated settlement?
It was certainly stated in the argument of counsel, but it's not something that was supported by affidavits or evidentiary.
Okay.
So
that was really not a basis for sustaining your argument. Your contention was the complaint alleges this because the settlement agreement says it. Deny the motion to dismiss.
That's, in short, yes, Your Honor, our argument.
Okay.
And also, I mean, there wasn't much discussion of it, but we would certainly say that there's nothing in the settlement agreement such as this that would be void for public policy under the statute. Obviously, employers and employees are not free to evade the workers' compensation system, but that's not what was done here. In this case, we had a disputed workers' compensation claim. It was being litigated, and as part of the final resolution of that that disputed claim, and it says it's disputed in the stipulation, certain terms were worked out as to how payment and compensation was to be paid to resolve that. And I think that's entirely consistent with the system. You know, one other thing that's argued by Rinker in this case is that there should be a motion to reopen the claims and that somehow that was the intention of the settlement agreement. I don't think we have to get there under the standard of review, but if you read the settlement agreement, and this court is obviously familiar with it from the questions that have been asked, it doesn't say anything about having to reopen the claim. It's clear that that was carved out, and then, of course, it's alleged in the complaint.
It's confusing to me that one would have to reopen a claim if the claim is already, is still, as to medications, is still pending.
That's true.
Nonsensical.
It is nonsensical, and I don't want to say this is our position, but there's certainly an argument that could be made that reopening would not be appropriate because reopening is based on a change of circumstances. And as you're alluding to, the payment of the medications and the doctor's visit was a continuing necessity, which is why it was being paid for during this entire process.
Well, there was never a determination as to the medication, so wouldn't it simply be submitted for determination?
Again, I don't think that was left open. I think the intention of the parties was that this would all be resolved.
Through a determination, I thought, at least reading it the way I read it, through the workers' comp system, being submitted for a determination because what's in the stipulation is completely open. It doesn't say for any term, any length of time. That's the way I read it.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, and also keep in mind that it wasn't simply the workers' compensation benefits and the amount of the benefits, the amount of the disability and that sort of thing that was at issue. There was also the resolution of the subrogation claim and the lien that was part of this settlement. So, I mean, it was global. I think it was a little bit beyond simply determination of the disability amount and the payments that were owing under the statutes. There was one last thing that I wanted to bring up in response to a question. Oh, Justice Hardesty. I'm going to give my two cents on what it meant to have this referred to the hearing officer. I agree that that was a little strange. I'm not sure that that proceeding had any binding effect whatsoever. It may have been entirely extrajudicial. Provided whatever information the district court wanted to obtain, but probably had no real legal effect in this case, I think is the best way to interpret that. Had the hearing officer made a different determination, maybe it would have been different. But really, I don't think it was necessarily something that, certainly not something the district court had to do, and certainly nothing the district court was obligated to follow. And I say that you know, also wanting to emphasize that what the hearing officer did was actually favorable to O'Connor by saying that that matter was left open.
So the matter was either left open for purposes of resolution between the parties, or it was written in such a way that it left the comp claim open. Is that a fair statement? I agree with you.
It's a good question, because when I said left open, I was ambiguous, and that's a fair question. When I say left open, I mean left open, left open for the resolution by the parties.
So not
agreement, and not left open,
not open in an existing comp
yes,
claim.
Yes.
Okay, because I agree with you that to suggest that the comp claim needs to be reopened,
right,
at least under one interpretation, doesn't make any sense.
Right. What it said is, and again, even what the agency officer said was a little ambiguous. Although the claim was considered closed, the closure did not affect continued medication. So that doesn't help us a whole lot, other than it certainly wasn't something that was resolved by the stipulation. That's at page 107 of the appendix. Unless the court has any other questions, I think that's all I have. Again, I mean, we're here on mandamus, on a motion to dismiss. The factual issues we don't think are before the court. It's simply a matter of whether the court has jurisdiction to hear the breach of contract claim. Where it'll go from here, who knows, but I think the answer is that the court does have jurisdiction. The petition should be denied.
You said mandamus, but you mean prohibition, right?
Prohibition, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I tend to use the two interchangeably,
well, no,
but yes.
I just wanted to make sure, because there's obviously a material difference between
yes,
the two.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr.
Stewart.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
Mr. Golden.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think the one thing that we can agree on is that the issue is whether the district court has jurisdiction over this matter. And when you actually look at the specific statutes within the Act, it shows that Mr. O'Connor has remedies to bring his claims administratively. And we had discussed whether it's a reopening or whether it's a continuous obligation or whether a continuous matter under the workers' comp system. And I think either way, it still needs to proceed through the workers' comp system and not in front of the district court. If you look at 616C.392, it provides for bringing a matter administratively when there's been a violation of 616D.120, which includes failure to pay under a written settlement agreement. And that's exactly what we have here. That's what Mr. O'Connor is alleging. That's not what we have here in terms of the facts, but as a matter of law, the district court should have dismissed this action and allowed it to proceed administratively so that the remedies under 616D.120 could be had. Now, if you also look at 616D.030, it provides that the remedies under .120 are exclusive, and that that a claimant cannot bring common law claims for violation of the Act. And that, again, is what is the situation we have here. Mr. O'Connor is alleging that there was a breach of the settlement agreement. Under .120, breach of a settlement agreement, or failure to pay by the employer, is a violation. And it allows for several remedies. It allows for a plan of corrective action, which would include payment to him if payment is found to be due by the administrative officer. It allows for him to receive a benefit penalty, which is in addition to payment. It allows for administrative fines, and it goes on to be as severe as Rinker could lose its certification, which would essentially shut it down from operating. This court in the Madera decision looked at 616D.030 and held that that statute essentially means what it says, that the remedies under 120 are exclusive. With that, the district court here, rather than submitting it back to the appeals officer, bringing it back, should have simply dismissed the matter, and that is what we're asking for today, a writ of prohibition to issue to prevent the case from proceeding and directing the district court to dismiss so it can proceed administratively.
Counsel, I have a question. If can a stipulation be written such that it would close a comp case, but agree, in essence, that it would continue to pay a particular benefit?
Yes, they're under 616C.495, which is the statute regarding lump sum payment for permanent partial disability. It can include, or the plain language of the statute shows that it can include payment for in a lump sum, but it doesn't have to totally exhaust the entire claim. But what we also have at issue here is a possible Chandler offset, which hasn't been really addressed, and that's if Mr. O'Connor wants to get those additional payments, if it's found that Rinker is obligated to pay them, he needs to show that he's exhausted his third-party settlement under the third-party tort action.
So in other words, even if the stipulation did a carve-out, as I suggested early in your argument, the question without the letter that you have to support your position would still, in your mind, would still have to go back to the agency, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Golden, Mr. Sterling, thank you for your arguments this morning. Case number 569-09, 56909 will stand submitted.